The Brendan O'Connor Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Discover a team that's always here to support you at All Care, taking care of communities across Ireland.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
I would like to say, in response to all the people from the wellness community who are texting in to say that they are not all mad conspiracy theorists, nobody is saying you are. Indeed, I have dabbled in yoga a little bit myself. I've let it lapse a bit, but I think I am still a rational enough individual. But absolutely, and listen, I think the wellness movement does a lot of good for a lot of people, actually. So nobody's suggesting you're all crazies, okay? Really. We love you, and Gaia loves you, and etc. Now, Owen Sweeney. This time last year, this is more crazy conspiracy theories, actually, when you think about it, right? Everything is connected. So this time last year, I was talking to David Hepworth, and he was the author of a book called 1971, Never a Dull Moment, Rock's Golden Year, right? So last year, 50 years on from 1971, we decided that everything is connected in 1971 was the best year for music. Now, as I sit here today, on the 50th anniversary of 1972... It strikes me that we could make an argument that 1972 was actually a golden year for rock music. And I hope you would agree with that, because...
Because it'll be a very short item if I don't.
Yes, So your kind of summation of it is rock grows up and gets rich. That's your overview of 72.
Yeah, the industry really kicks in. I suppose 71, David Hepworth is quite right. You can mention all the classic albums from Joni Mitchell to Carole King to the Who and the Stones or whatever you want to do and box it all up in a calendar year. It's kind of the end of the 60s, really. 72 is what we'll probably have a look at. Is kind of the 70s starting afresh. Everything's in colour. Everything's a bit different. Music sounds different. It's a bit more ethnically diverse, let's face it. Okay. Rock gets a kind of a bit of a wider definition. The album is the key kind of marketing tool, I suppose. And it starts to look at itself. So if we start in January 1972...
I'm wondering, are we looking at a move from... your marijuana to a more cocaine-based culture as well.
Absolutely. Things are a bit urban as well. Yeah, okay. Let's put it that way. A little less rustic, a bit more urban, a bit kind of grim in places, a bit kind of self-analytic, a bit socially aware. But also the industry, Brendan, is making lots of money. That's probably where the cocaine comes in.
Yeah, okay.
And starts repackaging itself, namely the 60s. If you start in January 1972, Paul Simon released his first solo album. He had one in pre-Simon and Garfunkel, you know, when he was touring around England and train stations and all that sort of stuff with a ticket for his destination. But 1972, he releases his first solo album. It's got Me and Julio Down the Schoolyard on it. It's got Mother and Child Reunion. You can kind of guess or get a sense of where he's going. He's looking around the world for different sounds. Yeah. Direct line to Graceland and Rhythm of the Saints and all
the
stuff.
So beginning his cultural appropriation.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And that kind of will spread outwards through other artists. But in the middle of 1972, Columbia, RCBS, decide, hang on a second, let's release Simon and Garfunkel's greatest hits, which they do. And so they package all these top 10 singles. I think nine of the 10 Simon and Garfunkel singles all went top 10 in the United States. They throw on a few kind of rare live tracks. They package it up as a single disc album and it goes on to sell tens of millions of copies.
Okay, and that so really suddenly realise, wow, okay.
Money for old rope here, you know. Okay, never mind, okay. Simon, you go and do your new stuff. We'll keep selling your old stuff and everyone will be happy. Okay. And that's kind of a real kind of totem for the 70s as well. It happens and, across the board.
And of course started a whole revolution in Ireland of fellas with guitars at parties and people singing in bars, and this is what they were singing.
In the clearing stands a boxer and a fighter by his trade, and he carries the reminders of every glove that laid him down or cut him till he cried out in his anger and his shame, I am leaving, I am leaving, but the fighter still remains.
Okay, only the producer is saying that was good kazoo work on that there. I was thinking, didgeridoo or something? And hadn't quite noticed how prominent that was before. Okay, so you're going to talk to me about the Rolling Stones.
Yes.
They changed that year. Things changed.
Things changed hugely that year. And this is important. It's kind of building on from Simon and Garfunkel's greatest hits, because the Stones had gotten away from and were in very much a post-Get Back Beatles world, aren't we? Everyone watched it. The Great Bet. Okay. noir of Get Back, of course, was Alan Klein. Alan Klein was in bed with the Stones before he was in bed with the Beatles. He retained copyright to all their stuff from the 60s and 70s. So the Stones now had broken free from that. They had a bunch of songs they hadn't recorded. Their lawyer went, lads, you owe an awful lot of money to the taxman. Get ye to France, which, you know, a lot of rock stars, you
said. All those bands were paying like 90% tax in the UK at that stage, weren't
they? Yeah, there was the Heath government now, but the Wilson government kind of brought that in. Of course, the Beatles talked about Taxman and Revolver and everything else. So they were very conscious of the money, if they had any at all, thanks to their contractual obligations, then they owed it to the taxman. So the Stones decamped to France. They did Exile on Main Street, a great double album. It was kind of the last of their great kind of heyday, kind of, you know, I suppose efforts. It was drenched in booze and drugs and everything else, but then they became these stadium gods. They were now, the Beatles had left the pitch, they were the biggest band.
So that was stadium rock proper begins.
And Zeppelin are happening in America at the same time as well, so stadiums are opening up now. Music would never be the same. They were out of touch of the ordinary man, which is kind of why punk happened eventually, as you can imagine. But also, I mean, Exile is kind of, you know, this double album. It's a bit excessive, but it is dissolute. It has got Tumbling Dice on it. It is Happy, a kind of a hit single sung by Keith Richards. But also interesting, and I mentioned Alan Klein for a reason, because in December 71, the Stones released, without their knowledge, what would become their biggest selling record, which was Hot Rock 64 to 71.
Every house had a copy.
Exactly. So, and there were three more compilations in 1972 alone, including the follow-up More Hits Than Dazed Cookies or whatever, the following Christmas. So Alan Klein is mining the Stones' 1960s heyday. And weirdly, just a little throw forward to 73, the Beatles, of course, who'd never been really anthologised, their Blue and Red compilation albums, which Klein, if, you know, legend is to be believed, was a big mover behind, were going to be packaged again then. So rock, the business was really looking at itself and thinking, all this money can be made.
In cash, it must have been at that stage. Yeah. This is also, 72 was the year that you say...
But Exile's a great record, to be fair.
Elton John broke through...
The legend that is Elton John, exactly. He'd been hanging around for a long time. This is his fifth album. Again, Brendan, where was it recorded? France. Why was it recorded in France? Because Elton owed a load of money to the taxman in the UK.
I didn't think money or possessions were important to Elton.
So this is Honky Chateau, which was the first of, count them, six number one albums in the United States in a row. That will tell you how many records he was shifting in the West Coast and the East Coast of America. And seven in a row, if you want to include Elton John's Greatest Hits, Volume 1, which closed, sold something like 17 million copies in America alone. So that's how many records. It's got Rocket Man on it. It is the birth of the legend. He'd had a kind of his first breakthrough single with Your Song a couple of years beforehand. But Elton John, the stadium performing piano, get up, crazy glasses, you know, the legend, the rock legend that he is, starts here.
Okay, now 71, a lot of female singer-songwriters had broken through. Not so much in 72, but you talk about Carly Simon's album in 72 and that this is kind of music for grown-ups, kind of.
The other aspect of rock getting rich, I suppose, is dinner party rock. It becomes a thing, you know, kind of smoochy, kind of lovers, kind of grown up. You know, you're not listening to singles anymore. You're listening to the long playing records. Yeah. The themes are a bit more adult. No Secrets by Carly Simon is a very sexually kind of aware record, shall we say. Very grown up themes. You're So Vain is the all conquering single on it that kind of towers over everything else in the album, rightly or wrongly. You mentioned, I mean, you know, Blue by Joni Mitchell came out in 71. She did another album in 72 for the Roses. Carole King, Rhymes and Reasons came out. Joan Armour Trading's first singer-songwriter album came out as well. The second Sandy Denny record. But Carly Simon's album is very much kind of something you put on the turntable in 1972.
Tasteful is the word I was looking for. Okay, so this is either about Mick Jagger or Warren Beatty, isn't it? Let's take it.
Yes, Mick Jagger's on it, of course.
You're So Vain. And kind of funky, isn't it? Languid,
laid back, languid, and tasteful are the words. And the other great totem of that is, of course, the debut by Steely Dan. which came out that year as well. Can't Buy a Thrill, another great one for the hi-fi, Brendan, in your shack,
yeah,
pile of
and musicianship and
yeah,
and, yeah,
everything was very slick, yeah, and yeah, very well done and slightly overproduced or perfect, yeah, whichever you prefer.
Okay, now people will call it glam. Like, I think Bowie and Lou Reed in 72, I think they're a bit of caught above your other glam acts, like, but it was kind of that. And the two of them kind of intertwined at this point, aren't they?
Bowie, of course, had been hanging around for ages. Again, his fifth record. You know, he couldn't get him. He had a one-hit wonder. He threatened to forever be a one-hit wonder with Space Oddity in 69. But he couldn't get arrested, really, outside of kind of, you know, his local kind of fandom in London.
And he'd had, Hunky Dory and Man Who Sold the World
were the two albums prior to
classics,
that.
But
They're the cognoscenti's choice. Hadn't broken through until he decided, right, he looked around at his pal Mark Bolan, he looked at Vince Taylor, he heard about the legendary Stardust Cowboy, he thought, right, I have a whole load of songs here. What if I put them around the theme of this bisexual space alien who's beamed down to Earth and becomes a rock star, hence Ziggy Stardust. That is the album that made Bowie a star. We talk about Elton John and Rocketman. Again, space themes, very 1970s, of course, yeah, as well. Yeah, he had Life on Mars prior to this. But famously, the big cliche, of course, but it is true, like all the good cliches, when he turned up on Top of the Pops in July 1972, Sting and Starman, the world on this side of the Atlantic, particularly in England, and also Bono talks about it as well, in Ireland too, if you had Top of the Pops, stopped. Where Bowie kind of put his arm loosely around Mick Ronson's shoulder. You know, famously, of course, truck drivers in Huddersfield were putting their boots through the television with disgust. But also he looked down the lens and said, you know, hey, that's far out. You know, I had to tell someone, so I picked on you. Do you know what I mean? Hey, that's far out. So you
and
heard
he
him
was
too.
Talking to Boy George, Gavin Friday. He's brought all
100%.
Of them one to one.
We wouldn't have Joy Division without this song. Do you know what I mean?
But then he also, and like these guys were massively prolific at that stage, weren't they? Like Bowie was releasing two albums a year at some
Absolutely.
Stage in the 70s. Yeah. But he also, I think, kind of like had a massive hand in Lou Reed's Transformer, which is probably Lou's most successfully executed album, isn't it?
Absolutely. And it's interesting to look at it because it's definitely kind of that Velvets. Bowie was a big Velvets fan. He did, obviously, he covered White Light, White Heat prodigiously in all his gigs, or most of his gigs at that time. Lou Reed was on his uppers. The Velvets hadn't sold a thing. Do you know what I mean? The band had imploded. He'd done a solo album that was pretty low energy. Bowie comes along, and Mick Ronson does a lot of the heavy lifting on this record, to be fair.
He's a guitarist too, from the Spiders from Mars, Hull guy.
Exactly.
Pub rocker from Hull.
Absolutely.
Who's
in a spanky jumpsuit.
Important figure. Yeah.
But he did all the arrangements on songs like Perfect Day. They wouldn't sound as great as they do because there was a lot of drugs going on at this time as well in Lou Reed's case. So they dragged him out of the gutter effectively in the Lower East Side of Manhattan and made him a superstar, and this is where the legend happens as well. So without Bowie's patronage, it wouldn't have happened. Yeah. You know, he did the same thing for Iggy Pop later on.
Walk on the Wild Side.
Walk on the Wild Side, Perfect Day, and of course Satellite of Love.
No, there's a third leg to this bit on glam, which I didn't quite realise that this was at the same time, because it seems quite far ahead in a way of where the others were at. But Roxy Music released their first album in 1972 as well.
That's right. And the single Virginia Plain came off, or it was around the same time as well. In fact, that was August 72. They appeared on Top of the Pops in the UK.
Do you know
that.
What? Let's just have a, before we talk about it, let's have a listen to Virginia Plain, because you just see how modern it sounds. So, like it or not, I mean, there's new wave right there. They do seem miles ahead of what Bowie and Lou were doing.
This is the thing. Bowie had been hanging around for ages doing singer-songwriting, doing mod stuff, doing whatever it was going to try and become a star. Becomes a star with glam, and then Roxy Music go and trump him effectively a few weeks later by releasing this record, which is the future.
Yeah,
and then he
kind
of, he's almost been flanked, so he has to catch up with them. You know, obviously, and it brings Brian Eno, you know, who looks like an alien. Do you know what I mean? Playing this record. And of course, he goes on to work with Bowie in Bowie's best period, if you ask me, you know, low later on in the 70s, but also he helps Daniel Lanois, Midwife, Joshua Tree and Octung Baby, U2's commercial and probably creative peaks into existence in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah. And now bringing it back to Ireland. So while all this was going on, we were having a kind of a Celtic revival here in Ireland in 1972. Yeah, we talk about Van first.
let's talk about Van, because Van, of course, was off in Northern California doing his thing with Tupelo Honey, and he'd done kind of Astral Weeks and stuff. But St. Dominic's Preview is one of the albums that almost kind of falls between the cracks. It's a great record. Do you know, it's almost a happy Van record. Let's say that. He's kind of light. He's airy. There's plenty of words there. But whereas like Springsteen would come along and overload his songs so much that they'd almost collapse under the verbosity of his lyrics, Van's kind of, they're much more dexterous. They're much more lyrical. They're much airier.
That's a very subtle point to be making, Anne. Okay, we're not going to play all the songs you've got here now, but I do think, look, I know Van is semi-cancelled these days, but Jackie Wilson said great. Yeah, that I think that swings is what you'd say about that, isn't it? Swings. Give us a brief overview of what else was going on in Irish artists.
Well, Celtic rock was invented that year, not by Van, but by Jim Lockhart et al. With Horslip's first album, Happy to Meet, Sorry to Part. And if you have a copy at home, it'll be concertina shaped. Do you remember it folded out because of their advertising background and design? Yeah. Fantastic record. That was their debut album. There you go. Prosperous by Christy Moore, his second record. But really, this is where Christy starts, and it's where Planxty start, because Donal Lunny's on it, Andy Irvine's on it, and Liam O'Gofflin is on it, and also kind of perennials like The Cliffs of Dunedin is on it as well. Now, Shades of Blue Orphanage, the second Lizzie album, came out, but much more importantly, Christmas number one in Ireland that year was Whiskey in the Jar by Thin Lizzy, and Rory Gallagher's Live! Exclamation mark, and also an upper or case letters in Europe, his kind of calling card. The Live album in rock kind of starts here as well. I mean, you know, Deep Purple etc. would do double live albums. Neil Diamond would do a double live album this year that also was in everyone's parents' bloody and mates' parents' record collections. But Rory kind of did primarily new stuff, two old tracks, but you know, that's the birth of Rory Gallagher there as a superstar.
Now, we mentioned about that, in you know, these days it's 5 years between albums. They were knocking out one and two a year back then. Let's talk about Aretha and Stevie Wonder, both two classic albums in 72.
Absolutely. Aretha, the recent movie Respect, actually finishes with her performance in the New Temple Missionary Baptist Church, he says, consulting his notes. I can't remember that off the top of his head, which is the Amazing Grace live album, which she sat on the footage for many, many years. It's since been seen, I think, on Apple TV because, you know, she resisted its publishing. But this is the best-selling gospel album of all time. It's a double album. It is a huge, monumental live vocal performance, and it's perfect for a Sunday.
We take a quick blast of How I Got Over. I'm gonna thank you because you brought me, Lord. Oh, yeah. I wanna thank you, Jesus, because you taught me. Oh, yeah. I wanna thank you because you kept me. Oh, yeah. I'm gonna thank you because you never left me. I wanna sing. Hallelujah. Lord, I just might shout this evening. My soul looks back and wonder. Yeah, that's the church.
You can hear the room, can't you? You can hear the church there. She also did Young, Gifted and Black, of course, a Nina Simone song. She did that album as well, one of her best-selling records, and that's where Aretha went political. Stevie Wonder starts his imperial phase that year as well.
So Stevie Wonder is, I know Berry Gordy was reluctant to let Stevie Wonder become a more conscious kind of artist and all that, but this is the year Stevie breaks out, is it?
Marvin Gaye had done What's Going On the previous year, so Stevie Wonder's, Berry Gordy's arm was forced, basically, where Stevie went, hang on a second, these are my 14th and 15th records for you guys, Motown. Motown, by the way, moved from Detroit to LA this year as well. So that was a definite change in their focus. Music of My Mind and Talking Book both came out by Stevie Wonder this year. He'd go on to do Inner Vision. This is the start of the legend that is Stevie Wonder. Also, it's where Prince came from, because frankly, Stevie Wonder plays almost everything apart from the brass on his most famous song, which is on Talking Book, which of course is Superstition.
Okay, and we haven't time to play Stevie because I do want to mention a lot of people think that it was Chris Blackwell, Island Records, brought Bob Marley and brought reggae out of Jamaica into the world. But actually, it was 1972 and it wasn't all about Bob Marley.
Not at all. In fact, Marley was very, very unknown here. It was Johnny Nash that brought Bob Marley to the world via I Can See Clearly Now, which is a great record. By the way, if you have Spotify or other streaming services, go and listen to some of these albums, because when you hear the songs in the context of the long players, it actually changes.
I listened to Johnny Nash's version of Stir It Up. I'd never really listened to it before. It's really good. But the Harder They Come soundtrack was the the big moment here.
It was the big moment. It's the best of reggae. It's the best of Jimmy Cliff. I mean, The Harder They Come by Jimmy Cliff is on there, of course. You can get it if you really want. It's on there. But The Rivers of Babylon's on there as well. Johnny Tuba, 007. You know, Toots and the Maytals there with Pressure Drop as well. It is fantastic reggae.
So this is when all these artists were really introduced to the world.
This
properly.
Album going to America, this album, more so than the film, because obviously it's based on a film set in Jamaican, in Jamaica at the time. This album is, you can imagine Johnny Rotten having this album. This is what The Clash had. This is what half of New York had. This is what half of Miami had. This is what all of LA had. This was reggae going global. Marley wouldn't happen until the next year on Island Records.
Let's take a blast of Jimmy Cliff, The Harder They Come. There we go, Jimmy Cliff. And listen, we're not even getting to the birth of Philly Soul and
the OJs and Harold Melvin and all those goodies.
And then heavy metal kind of came to the world this year, and prog and everything as well.
We
should have made this a double album. And if you want to buy the box set, you can listen to Owen's 23 minute long discussion of prog rock. It's all one track. And it's Owen Sweeney, fascinating. You get a book out of that. There, that was 1972. That's our conspiracy theory that it was a great year for music. All right, let's take a break.
Email brendan@rte.ie.